You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll take a look back at the Selma Civil Rights March, hear about a benefit that's going on tonight in Sioux City, and we'll have some music. But first, the details of two controversial bills the Iowa legislature passed last week. On Wednesday, the Iowa House gave final approval to a measure that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. The other bill passed late last week greatly expands Second Amendment rights in Iowa. The bill would allow children to use handguns under adult supervision, enhance existing stand your ground laws, create an avenue for Iowans to sue cities or counties that enact gun-free zones, legalize short-barreled rifles and shotguns, and allow permit holders to carry handguns in the Capitol. Speaking at his weekly news conference in Des Moines, the governor didn't go as far as saying he would sign the bill. John Wills is a Republican representative from Spirit Lake. He says the bill was meant to make Iowa safer.
Not everybody agrees with this, but I think on the Republican, especially the conservative side, you know, we view gun rights as being a right that is really not one that can be taken away. And so we have had and seen erosion of our Second Amendment rights for quite a few years. And so this gun bill that we just accomplished is really a historic gun bill for the state of Iowa. It returns a lot of rights to our citizens. You don't have to own a gun if you don't want, but if you do, it gives you, if you do want to own it, gives you a little bit more ease in that owning, gives you a little bit more ease in where you carry that gun if you have a concealed carry permit and that sort of thing. It's really about returning freedom back to our state, returning freedom back to our citizens.
I know during the debate, there were some legislators who were concerned about the possibility of disgruntled people, either at the state house, the courts, other law enforcement agencies coming in with guns, you know, looking for a fight.
Well, and that's a discussion that's been made, that's been talked about. And, you know, I just refute that by saying, you know, where are the people who want to shoot others going to go? They're not going to go to a place that has armed guards in it. They're going to go in a gun-free zone. And so, you know, you got school shootings happening at schools, and they're gun-free zones. The criminals are not really following the law. And they're taking guns wherever they want. And it's really, this bill is all about freedoms for law-abiding citizens. It's not about the criminals. And that's kind of what our country is framed on. It's framed on that, you know, even our court system is framed on that we'd rather see a guilty person go free than convict a innocent person. And so that's really what we've got to reframe our thinking on back in this country, is that everybody is not innocent until they're proven guilty. And we can't take away rights from people when they're law-abiding just because somebody may commit a crime. That's not the way our country is founded.
I know a lot of people had come to the state house and saying they were worried about the stand your ground portion of the bill.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's a area of the law that didn't really change a whole lot. It did give people a little bit less requirement to try to get away, and it did remove the ability for somebody who has attacked somebody and has been lawfully then shot by the innocent person to not be sued. So the person who is defending themselves, it gives the ability to not be civilly sued by the person that they shot if that person was trying to attack them and trying to injure them or harm them in some way. And we think that that's just a prudent thing. Anyway, why, if I'm attacking you, for example, why should I then be able to come back and sue you if you lawfully and legally defended yourself and prevented me from attacking you? That's crazy. And that's happened. That has happened in our state and in our country.
I know several other states have stand your ground kind of laws.
Right. And we, to be honest, we've always had a kind of a stand your ground. The only caveat to that is unless you're in your home or in your car or something like that, you had a duty to try to retreat. That was the only difference. So we've always kind of had it already. Now what we've done is we've taken that duty to retreat out, even if you're just on the street walking. You know, if you're fearing for your life, trying to retreat could actually cost you your life. And so we've said, okay, we're going to try to remove that duty to retreat and say, if you fear for your life, then you can defend yourself. You don't have to try to retreat.
In a move that was applauded by a lot of abortion foes, the Republicans managed to pass a bill that would prevent abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
Well, what we did was we added a few things to it. This was a Senate bill. We were able to add a few things to it. Of course, we did try to add a heartbeat amendment to it. That failed. We didn't have enough votes within the Republican Party down there. But we added a 72-hour waiting period for a woman who is looking at having an abortion. So she goes into the abortion provider, and the abortion provider has to do a sonogram and give her the option of viewing the baby, has to give her the option of hearing the baby's heartbeat, and then provide that woman with literature, and then she has a 72-hour waiting period, or I'd call it a cooling-off period, just to make sure she's doing the right thing. Doesn't mean that she can't have the abortion, but it just says, hey, let's do a cooling-off period. You're going to have materials that you can read about adoption. You're going to have materials that you can read about government programs that can help you if you need help. It's all about saving babies. You know, it's all about saving that baby and also giving that woman other options besides just having the abortion.
That was Republican State Representative John Wills from Spirit Lake in Dickinson County. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The March on Selma took place more than 50 years ago. Gordon Watson was a student at Morningside College at the time. He and some other Morningside students took part in the march. The retired minister from Spencer says he and his fellow students drove from Sioux City on a Sunday to join the march, and there were fire hoses and dogs attacking the marchers. But the northern marchers were targets of yet more violence on the way out of town.
It was really bad. And that's when the fire hoses came out and the police dogs and stuff. On the following Tuesday, they tried to march again. And Martin Luther King convinced them to turn back because they were waiting for an injunction from the federal government after the judge had issued the order that they could march. They started out again from Selma, and it was relatively peaceful during the march itself. Of course, by then they had federal troops there, and the National Guard had been federalized and things like that. So the actual march itself along the highway was quite uneventful. And when we got to Montgomery, of course, they were anticipating the crowds, and it was a fairly calm setting after that. The violence then came after the march on Thursday afternoon as people were leaving, and then the Ku Klux Klan and others were out to get us. And we were warned at the conclusion of the gathering on the steps of the Capitol that those of us with northern license plates should immediately head out of town. And having northern license plates, we took their word for it and left. And about 30 minutes after we had left the place where we had been staying at this community center, we turned on the radio and learned that the community center where we had been staying had been firebombed and burnt to the ground. So that was as close as we got to actual violence. That same night is a lady from Michigan was shuttling people from Montgomery back to Selma. She was killed in her car and run off the road and killed by what later was determined to be members of the Ku Klux Klan. So,
were you at all afraid? Did you understand how dangerous it really was before you got into this?
No. Being college students, I don't think we had, Northern college students especially, we really didn't have much of a sense of the danger going down. Of course, we hadn't given it a whole lot of thought between Sunday night and Monday morning. Basically, it was as we were coming back when we really got scared. And we made the trip back to Sioux City in about two or three hours less than what it had taken us to get down. I think some of that probably had to do with a certain amount of fear. But we were told at the end of the march itself, very firmly, they said, don't mess around. Get in your cars and head north as quickly as you can. So I think that's when we had time to kind of, you know, think about things, and then hearing different reports on the radio, that's when we became more fearful than before. And there hadn't been a lot of publicity or news accounts and stuff before that we were aware of. You know, like my wife and I said, we didn't have a TV and we seldom listened to the radio. So I think the fearfulness of the trip really set in as we were coming back.
Afterward, in the aftermath of it, were you satisfied that it made a difference?
Absolutely, especially as the events between the time of the march and the fact that Lyndon Johnson then signed the voting rights bill in August of that same year, we became more aware of the perspective of the whole story. You know, most of us didn't have any as the film portrayed, didn't really have any sense of what was going on in the Congress and between Johnson and the Attorney General.
You didn't have instant news, and
frankly, being from where we were at the time, we really didn't have a whole lot of sense of the real imminent danger of.
Oh, I thought you meant sense.
Well, we didn't have much sense either, looking back on it. But I would say that's where the awareness came, is later on.
What did the students, the Morningside students, ask you when you were over there?
Well, it was very interesting. It was kind of beyond my expectation because we didn't know what to expect. The three of us who were at that event that night had a chance to talk ahead of time over dinner, and one of the students had already been down there for about 8 days doing voter registration. The third student that was there that night, they arrived just in time for the Thursday march because their car broke down. We were there, like I say, Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday, and Thursday. So we all had different perspectives, of course, and different experiences that way. But the students themselves really asked some very penetrating questions. You know, 52 years later, you're not sure that anybody's going to really care or not. I mean, it was a historical event, but the questions they asked had to do a lot with personal perspectives that we had, the hatred of many of the Southern people. Those kinds of things were very interesting to me. There were some questions about the technology of the thing. Well, with 25,000 people back in 65, could you hear the speakers? You know, that sort of thing. But most of the questions had to do with relationships and the people that we met, the people that we dealt with, both persons coming in and also persons who were in the lived down there. And that was what was interesting to me about it. And a good deal of the question-answer hour was spent in those.
Would you advise a person today, especially a young person, to take part in something like this?
Well, and they asked that several times too. But yes, I would. I believe in the principle of nonviolence and of demonstrating for specific purposes, which that one was very clear. It was aimed at the getting a voting rights bill passed. And I think large groups of people do make a difference. Like Martin Luther King was saying, the principle of the thing is to get on the news, frankly, and let the country know what's going on. And I think that's still one of the better ways to call attention to those things. But I would always warn people who ask that, be patient, because it isn't going to happen overnight.
Because a lot of people are protesting now
about right.
What's going on in the new Trump administration.
Well, I would be there protesting as well, frankly.
That was Gordon Watson, who more than 50 years ago took part in the Selma Civil Rights Marches. He was a student at Morningside College at the time. He's now a retired pastor who lives in Spencer, Iowa. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Tonight, the Sanford Center will hold an event at the Orpheum Theater featuring Mitch and Emily Martin, Play It Forward, Kevin Keene, and more. The center itself has served the Siouxland community since the 1930s, beginning as a settlement house for African Americans migrating north. Over time, its role in the community has expanded, setting up affordable educational daycare, going into schools to help students and diminish gang presence, feeding families, and more. Much of this growth happened under the directorship of George Boykin. Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford of We Are Not a Monolith sat down with Boykin and later his successor, Fitzgerald Grant, to talk about the center, its past, present, and future.
Well, Mr. Boykin, we've invited you on the show today to talk about the Sanford Center, what it is, how long it's been here in Sioux City.
Okay, yeah, it's one of two neighborhood settlement houses. The Sanford Center was built basically in 1951. But before that, it was called the Booker T. Washington Center.
Okay.
And Mrs. Trosper and some other women in the community, Beulah Webb, the Herefords, and some other folks started the Booker T. Washington Center in 1933. And that agency was located above a drugstore on West 7th Street and was basically one room. And they had activities for black youngsters during those days, and you know, basically on the weekends mostly. And Mrs. Trosper was very good friends with Mary Trelia and also Stella Sanford and Art Sanford. And Stella finally convinced her husband, Art, that we blacks needed a place, you know, in Sioux City where we could go and have our social functions and gatherings and things of that sort and have our club meetings and whatever, because those kind of facilities was not available for black people in Sioux City. And the only places that we had basically were the churches. Right. Said those were the only places we had to go socially that was wholesome for the family, kept mm-hmm. the family together.
Exactly.
Of course, there was some businesses owned by black people in Sioux City. And those places were some nightclubs, barbecue joints, okay. places like that. And basically that was it. So there's a really deep history of black people in this community. And the Sanford Center has been a part of that for a very, very long time. There was a lot of black people that came out of the South that transitioned out of the South to places like Detroit, Michigan, and Chicago, and some stayed here. Not very many. I mean, right. We've only had a small population of black people for a very long time in this community.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, that transition and that movement, Mrs. Trosper is one of the permanent residents that helped black people that wanted to stay here to make that transition to this community. And my family was one of those, because my parents came out of Mississippi in 1930. And mom and dad, they were on their way to Chicago. And I had, my father had two brothers that had already came up here earlier. They had come up in the early 1920s. And they said to my dad, if you stay here, we can get you a job in the packing houses. Mm-hmm. And so dad, mom says, okay, we'll stay.
Yeah.
And so they stayed here, and that's how we ended up here.
Wow.
But as a result of that, them coming up here, the Sanford Center has been a part of my life, all of my life, because Mrs. Trosper was, and some of those people that I've just earlier mentioned were women that helped them make the transition to this community, because they didn't have anything. They didn't have any money. They had just the clothes on their back and a suitcase.
Do you remember when the Sanford Center was built in 1951,
yeah,
when it made that transition?
I do, yeah.
You do. What do you remember about that?
I was probably about 10 or 11 years old when that center was built. It was dedicated in 1951, and that was a really, really big deal for the black community. My parents brought us youngsters to that dedication in 1951, and so we've been a part of that center since its inception. And again, it was a brand new building, you know, first brand new building black people have ever had in the community.
Yeah. Right.
And it was just shiny new, just wonderful. And it was explained to us that this was a place for us, and that also we would not exclude any other groups that wanted to use the center, which we've never done. So that gave a place for people to have their wedding receptions, their funeral receptions, their potlucks. There was, at that time, a number of black women's clubs.
Okay.
And they were able to finally have a place where they could have their monthly meetings, right, or whatever in the center. There were also women's clubs that were made up by the majority women, white women in the community, but black women weren't allowed to join those. So this was a perfect opportunity for those women's clubs to grow and to have a place to do their thing and that kind of thing.
So a lot of this, I mean, came out of necessity.
It
came,
yes, it did. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're in the 50s right now with the community center. When did it start to make its transition into serving? I guess in my perspective now, the Sanford Center really serves the youth of Sioux City.
Right. Well, the center has always had a tradition of supporting the youth and being a character building institution specifically for youth of color in the community. But absolutely, to answer your question more thoroughly, we started to become a more of a citywide agency basically when I started the gang outreach program in 1992.
Okay.
When I put the outreach workers in Woodrow Wilson School in 1992 to get that school back under control, out of the control of disruptive parents, kids, right, gangs, that kind of thing, that's when the center expanded its influence in the community as a community agency.
Right.
And it's grown since then. I don't feel that we are a neighborhood settlement house any longer. We still have that title, but we're more of a settlement house that impacts the entire Siouxland area. In fact,
absolutely,
we impact the state,
yeah,
because of that particular program.
What was 1992 like? What was going on that made you and other people in the community realize?
The officials of Sioux City, the leadership of Sioux City, recognized that we were going to have gang problems in Sioux City. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of graffiti going up. We started to have, again, problems in our school, particularly Woodrow Wilson. And I think the chief juvenile court officer of the county put together a committee called the Gang Task Force Committee. Okay. And on that committee was the Sanford Center, the police chief, Department of Human Services, the superintendent of schools, and business folks. And we started to have meetings on how we could confront and diminish that impact that was happening in our community of gang activity. Mm-hmm. The school system talked about the issues that they were having with youngsters in school and their parents. Woodrow Wilson was one of the schools that was the most impacted school. And there were some other agencies represented on that committee too, not only the Sanford Center, but Boys Club and some of the other agencies. I had said that I had some idea of how we could confront this. And so I had written a proposal to the state for some OJJGP money.
Okay.
We weren't successful in getting a grant. They gave the money to some other part of the state. But the problem got so crucial,
right,
you know, in Sioux City that the district came to me along with the chief juvenile court officer and sat down with me at the Sanford Center and said, can you help us? We've got a real need in this particular school. And I said, yes, I can. I says, but I'm going to need some funds to do that. I said, I cannot do that with my current staff and with the current budget that I have. It'd be impossible. Yeah. And they said, well, what would you do? I said, well, what I would do, I'd put the outreach workers in those schools and work with those kids directly. Anytime one of your staff would have a problem with a youngster in the classroom, those people would be on call to come to resolve that issue in that classroom. Exactly. And that's exactly what Fitz Grant, George Sayavong, and Joe Vidalis did when they were at Woodrow Wilson. Hmm. That year, they took more than a dozen weapons from those youngsters in that particular school. They stopped gang fights from occurring around that school. Some of my outreach workers, specifically Fitz Grant, his life was threatened by some of the gang members and said that you're interfering with our business and we're going to get you, this kind of thing. So that's how that program basically got going. And I had some brave, brave people.
Yeah.
So we're here with Fitz Grant at the Sanford Community Center. Fitz, when and how did you start working for the Sanford Center?
Oh, let's see. Oh, wow. No, I came to the Sanford Center back in 1992, 93. Initially, I started as a gang outreach specialist at Woodrow Wilson Middle School. At the time, there were probably 35 organized gangs, over 1,500 gang members within the Siouxland community. And at the time, these kids were bringing weapons to school, and they were dealing drugs within the school. And they actually, you know, had a lot of gang activities going within the school. They were fighting all the time and, you know, just gang stuff, what gangs do. So we were put there to bring the school under control.
How did you do that?
We were newbies at this because when we look back at the gang situation here in the late 80s, they started to infiltrate the Siouxland community. And there are a number of reasons why they came into this area, and I won't give one, but they landed here in Sioux City, Iowa. And when it started happening, they knew that kids were doing some activities in those schools that needed to stop, needed to cease right away. And I'm a college graduate from Briarcliff, so I had some experience because of my education, but more importantly, I worked at the Boys Club as a target outreach gang specialist as well, too. So I had an idea in terms of what was going on in the city because I had some experience. But when we got in there, we weren't really sure because it was something new. We were actually on the street. It was a new program started by George Boykin. It was an innovative program. Something like this had never been done before, where you put workers in the school working directly with students, building a caseload, but more importantly, able to gain access into the home, but at the same time, have a relationship with law enforcement to work with these kids and more or less bring the community together.
So were you successful in that? And what do you see now with the whole gang prevention?
Absolutely, we were successful. You know, when we went into Woodrow Wilson School was in bad shape. And within 2 to 3 years of being into that school won a fine award for the state of Iowa based on our program, based on our presence. We were able to limit the gang activity. We were able to keep the guns out of school. But more importantly, we were able to help these young kids move on to the next level, which will be high school in that case. Right now, we probably hover around maybe 3 to 5 organized gangs. Maybe not more than 200 gang members in the city. And we kind of stay on top of the different trends within the community. I think we've been very successful. We've seen a lot of kids go off to college. We see a lot of kids in this community hold down jobs, have families, things of that sort. So, yeah, it's been very successful because it's been thousands of kids over the last, you know, 20 plus years.
You had mentioned that you took over as executive director this past July.
Yes.
Right? How has that been?
It has been great. I mean, I just think the love has been somewhat overwhelming. You know, I've worked there for 25 years. So I wouldn't say it was easy, but I guess I was able to find my way rather quickly in this position. Having come up through the ranks of Mr. Boykin and him teaching me the ins and outs like that has allowed me to progress rather quickly in this position. It has been great, you know, just getting out there, sharing our mission with people and talking about the new idea, some of the things we want to do here. It's been fun.
Because like you said, you've been here 25 years, but now you have the opportunity to man the ship. So what's been the most surprising thing for you?
Just being able to implement ideas, new things that I've had bottled up inside of me for the last 20 plus years. And as a new exec, some of those ideas that I had long ago, I can start to see become reality. And yeah, it's been fun to try new things and to bring people in. But I think the one thing that comes to mind as I talk a little bit more, this job has taught me patience. It has taught me patience. Things don't happen overnight. You have to be patient.
Right.
And more importantly, too, hey, my faith has grown tremendously. I always tell people, you know, I'm just a steward. You know, I don't care about the titles. You don't even have to know my name. I'm just a steward here at the Sanford Center. So, yeah.
Let me ask you about a day in the Sanford Center today.
Wow. You know, today as a new executive director, we're doing a lot of great things at the Sanford Center now. You know, I took over in July of last year. And some of the new things that I wanted to do as a new executive director was rebrand the agency. As you know now, we have a new logo. We have a new tagline, Building Community. Because after I did my research and after being here and listening to some of the story, that's something that the center actually did. They built a better community. We got new signage coming in front of our facility. We're doing some updating. We're kind of doing a look at how we deliver our services to the community and make sure that we're providing a quality service to the community. But more importantly, we want to expand our services throughout the Siouxland or Sioux City area. We're looking at here in the next couple of years to do some expansion over in the Morningside area.
So the Sanford Center has caseworkers?
Absolutely. They work at the inside the Sioux City Public Schools.
In the school?
In the schools, yeah. Okay. They work in the school. And we call those people outreach workers. They have 17 to 20 kids on their caseload. And now, doesn't mean that they stay at 17 to 20. They can exceed probably up to maybe 35, 40 kids. And those are the non-caseload kids where we provide services. So they're there to help these kids look at behavior issues, academics, social skills, things of that sort. But more importantly, to push these kids to graduate from the school. Yeah.
You know, you said that when you guys started, especially with the gang prevention stuff,
yeah,
you were pretty successful at getting that curb. And now there's still work to be done because
absolutely,
you have kids that need to graduate. And one thing I want to hit, you know, I know that the Sanford Center was built by blacks, but you help a lot of people.
Absolutely. You know, one thing about the Sanford Center, we look past the color barrier. We want to be inclusive. But more importantly, we want to build a better community. And guess what? Not just people of color live there. There's all walks of life that live here in this community. And we want to be an agency where people can feel that they're at home, but more importantly, where they can trust. So we have to open up our doors. But more importantly, we have to get out there in the community and look for those needs and be willing to meet those needs and the people that we serve. So, yeah.
Fitz, I read on your website that the Sanford Center also helps families of kids that come to the Sanford Center.
Absolutely.
How do you do that?
Absolutely. I mean, for example, if we get a call from a family member, they may need some food. You know, we have a pantry down here where we can, you know, put a box together and make sure that these kids have something to eat. Or if families may need, you know, a ride someplace, we're able to provide rides. And I tell you of a story of a mother. She moved from Chicago, and she was in the community probably 3-4 years before her sons actually enrolled here at the Sanford Center. But it was a time where she was having another child, and she wasn't able to go to the grocery store. And because of the weather we were having, she was afraid to catch the bus because it was snowing. And she was like, well, you know, I'm not going to have any food, whatever, whatever, and I can't get out because I got this baby. And I said, well, listen, why don't you give me the list and I'll go and shop for you.
Wow.
So I went out and shopped for
wow
her, too. So, yeah, so we're able to, like I said, get out in the community, see the needs, but more importantly, meet the needs.
That's
what we want to do, meet the needs. And that's how we build a better community.
When you are running a center like this, how important is it to make sure that your spirits are up, your energy is up?
If I'm not upbeat, if I'm not looking for the positive, then everybody's going to fail, in a sense. As their leader, I have to be optimistic. Hmm. I have to go and fight on the behalf of the workers that work here, the families that we serve, and just the community as a whole. If they see me down and out, guess what? They take on that type of attitude too. I have to show them that there's hope. So therefore, I pray and I ask God to continue to give me hope to see the good. And that's why I'm able to do what I do.
So you're living that brand, that new brand.
Absolutely. One thing I do, I love people. Every time you see me, I'm smiling. I'm having a good time because I love people. And I think because, like I said, when you love what you do and that joy is inside of you, I always tell people, I have no time to frown. So therefore, you would never see wrinkles on my face. I'm always laughing. I'm staying upbeat. I'm looking for the good all the time. And if you look for the good, that's what you're going to find is good things. If you look for bad, guess what? You're going to find bad things. And I think this community, the Siouxland community, is a great community. Like I said, my faith, it means everything to me, because without it, you know, I wouldn't be able to be right here. And I you know, I talked about being here for 25 years. You know, sometimes I felt like I should have been here earlier, but I believe that God prepares you for certain assignments in your life. And what he taught me was the patience of all of this. And now that I'm here, I can understand why he didn't give it to me 10, maybe 15 years ago. And he's, okay, listen, this is your timing right now, Fitz.
That was Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford of We Are Not a Monolith, who sat down with George Boykin and later his successor at the Sanford Center, Fitzgerald Grant, to talk about the center and a benefit that's being held tonight for the center at the Orpheum Theater. Julie Halas is with Play It Forward. She's a singer who will be performing at the benefit tonight. I talked with her about her music and the benefit.
Now, what kind of music do you sing?
You know, it's a variety of music. A lot of the times, it just depends on who has asked us to sing for them. This one that's coming up for the Sanford Center, their theme is blues and gospel and blues. So I'm going to be doing a blues number, and Bob is going to be doing a blues number. He thinks so, yes.
You're a accompanist?
Yeah, and Bob is also a music teacher. And so, and Bob sings as well. He's got a lovely voice. Well, the song I'm going to be singing is called When Sunny Gets Blue. I've been doing a lot of jazz music lately. Terry Brooks and I do music down at M's Pub. In fact, this Thursday, we're going to be doing some music there. So I've been focusing a lot on jazz and blues. So this song is called When Sunny Gets Blue.
All right, I can't wait to hear it.
Great.
When sunny gets blue, her eyes get gray and cloudy, then the rain begins to fall. Pitter-patter, pitter-patter, love is gone, so what can matter? No sweet loving man comes to call. When sunny gets blue, she breathes a sigh of sadness, like the wind that stirs the trees. Wind that sets the leaves to swaying, like some violins a-playing weird and haunting melodies. Oh, people used to love to hear her laugh, see her smile. That's how she got her name. Since the sad affair, she's lost her smile, changed her style. Somehow she's not the same. But memories will fade and pretty dreams will rise up where her other dreams fell through. Hurry, new love, hurry here to cast away each lonely tear and hold her near when sunny gets blue. Style. Somehow she's not the same, but memories memories will fade and pretty dreams will rise up where her other dreams fell through. Hurry, new love, hurry here to cast away each lonely tear and hold her near when sunny gets blue.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
That was Julie Halas of Play It Forward. She'll be singing tonight at a benefit for the Sanford Center at the Orpheum Theater. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While globetrotting wasn't the goal, Suzanne Hendricks Case pursued a travel-intensive opera career to gain credibility as a vocal coach she always wanted to teach. By a fortuitous turn of events, that desire led the classically trained singer to perform with the San Francisco Opera, the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and the Oper Frankfurt in Germany, one of the leading opera houses in Europe. After several years as a self-employed opera singer, Hendricks Case has finally settled in her first full-time college-level teaching job as an assistant professor of voice at Morningside College. She is Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. Allie Carson has more.
So you didn't set out to have a career in opera singing. That wasn't the goal.
No, not at all. As it turned out, I have a very unique voice type. And so people who sing the type of opera that I do, which would be dramatic mezzo-soprano rep, are just very few and far between. And so when you have that kind of voice, you stand out. And so then you get more opportunities, a little bit easier than just a regular lyric soprano, which there are many of.
Well, when did you find out that you could sing like that?
It took years. I did my undergraduate and master's degrees at University of Northern Iowa. And through that time, I think we knew I had a nice voice. The general rule for singing is the larger and lower your voice is, the longer it takes to develop. I have basically the largest and lowest female type voice that there is. So it wasn't until I was maybe 27 that it was sort of like the bottom dropped out of my voice. You could compare it to puberty and a teenage boy. And all of a sudden my voice became much louder and much darker. And we said, oh, I think this was what the problem was and why it was taking so long, which is why I hadn't aspired to become an opera singer, because we didn't really know that the native talent was there until I was older.
Well, how old are you now?
I've been singing this repertoire for about 10 years, so you can probably do the math.
Well, and does your voice keep changing as you get older?
It does, actually. You can't, in this Fach, which is the word F-A-C-H, it's a German word for voice types. So for my voice type, my Fach, you can't expect somebody to be mature and sing the rep that's appropriate for them until they're 35. So right now is when I'm finally kind of settling into the swing of things, and I should be slowly maybe improving in small increments until potentially even 50. Dolores Zajac is probably the most famous mezzo-soprano in my voice type right now in the world, and I believe she's in her 60s, and she still sounds fresh as a daisy because she's amazing. So if managed correctly, my voice type has quite a bit of longevity.
You've traveled a lot in your career, especially in 2014 when you were performing in Wichita, Kansas, Memphis, Tennessee, Geneva, Switzerland, San Francisco, and Chicago. And I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but logistically, you know, how does that work? Where do you live?
Yeah, 2013-14 was very busy. It happened to be Wagner's 200th birthday. So everybody was doing Wagner, which for me is perfect because that is the exact type of repertoire that I sing. And so I think that year I had maybe a total of 3.5 months at home. Kansas City, which is where I was at the time, was cheap enough that keeping an apartment there was not such a problem. But yeah, I had friends coming in and checking on it and making sure nothing was happening while I was gone. And it's tricky. You spend a lot of time on Facebook messaging people and Skyping and that kind of thing.
Because otherwise, I mean, are you like living out of a hotel then when you're out performing?
Sometimes. Some of the jobs are hotels. Other times we get long-term apartment rentals. So Airbnb has been very useful for opera singers. Like for instance, last year in Frankfurt, I lived in the top story apartment of this kind of three-level house that the guy in the middle level owned it. And actually his father was a famous opera singer randomly, which was strange. But yeah, I had my own kitchen, washing machine, living room, bedroom. So I really had my own apartment, but with two small suitcases worth of stuff for 2 months.
Well, have you met some interesting people then through your performing and, you know, doing Airbnb when you're out there, you know, get to stay with people?
You meet a lot of characters. And also I've been lucky that I've been in a lot of the big international houses. So I've worked with some really famous opera singers. My first truly professional job, which not as a young artist, would have been at San Francisco Opera, and I was in the Die Walküre there, and Nina Stemma was singing her first Brunhilde in Valkyrie, and she is one of the preeminent dramatic sopranos in the world right now. So that was nice and intimidating to work with her my first time out. But she's lovely, and I was really fortunate. Spate Jenkins in the Wagner world. He just recently retired. He ran Seattle Opera for years, and I was involved in his last ring cycle. Was really lucky that he took me in his last, you know, couple years he was working and made me part of his organization.
So you said, you know, you've really only been doing opera for a good 10 years at this point. And you know, how did the reality of being an opera singer line up with the expectations? Or, you know, what did you think it would be and what did you actually find?
I think I was lucky because I was a little older than most of my friends. I really didn't start going out and doing things until I was 30, for the most part. It sounds glamorous, but there are a lot of, you know, kind of hard realities when you're in Austria for 3 months. My husband and I, when I was singing at Vienna State Opera for a 3 month span, and we were engaged. It was a last minute job, 2 weeks notice. So I was planning my wedding from Vienna over the internet. And that's not the kind of thing I think you imagine for your life. Oh, I'm going to get married and plan my wedding on a different continent.
It sounds fun. Like, oh, I planned my wedding from Vienna.
It sounds fun. It was stressful when nobody responded to emails. I thought, how am I supposed to order a cake? We need a cake. But you learn to work through it. It just, you learn a lot of skills on the fly.
So why did you switch from a full performance schedule to teaching?
The realities of the lifestyle. As I mentioned, I am married, and I think, yeah, that planning the wedding from Austria was just sort of, this is ridiculous. And I like to spend time with my husband and my dog. And those types of things were enticing. Also, I always wanted to teach. And I think if you're especially in a creative field, you have to decide what is meaningful to you in your life. And I know a lot of people that find meaning in performing, and to them what they bring to the audience is very fulfilling. But for me, I find that working with students is significantly more fulfilling than the performing. So knowing that there is a way I could be settled, still have opportunities to go off and sing occasionally, but also have that extra element of working with young people, which I find fulfilling. I think it just all seemed to make sense.
Well, do you have any performances coming up?
I actually just won an award from the Goethe Listener Foundation in New York. And as part of that, I have to make the terrible hardship of singing in a recital at Carnegie Hall at the end of April. So I'm heading back to New York in a couple weeks. So I'll be singing in that recital. And then in June, I'm singing in an opera with Wichita Grand Opera. They've helped me a lot through the early stages of my career. And that's going to be Noah's Flood with Sam Raimi, who is one of the most famous opera singers from kind of the previous generation, but he's still amazing. I've seen him sing recently, and I am playing his wife, but which happens in opera frequently, but it's exciting to get to work with him and really work with him, not just in the chorus.
So at Carnegie Hall, will that be your first time singing there?
Yes, that will be my first time. So that's going to be kind of a fun thing to add to the resume.
Yeah. Well, what is one of the highlights of your career? You know, one of the places that it's like, oh my gosh, I'm standing on stage at...
I think the first time it happened was San Francisco Opera, because that was very early in my career. I was in the Young Artist Program there, and the house is just beautiful. If you've seen Pretty Woman, that's where he takes her to the opera, is San Francisco. And there's a reason they picked that opera house. And then I would say also Vienna State Opera, just because there's such a history at that opera house.
I've been talking to Suzanne Hendricks-Case, Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. She will be performing in a radio variety show at Epley Auditorium on Friday, April 21, for Siouxland Public Media's annual Spring Fun Drive. The live broadcast will take place from 10 a.m. to noon. It is free and open to the public. In a private recording session at Epley Auditorium, here is Suzanne Hendricks-Case singing
Ride la Vampa from Il Trovatore by Giuseppe Verdi.
That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Allie Carson, Mark Munger, Rick Turner, and Steve Smith. I'm Mary Hartnett. See you next Wednesday at noon.